This morning, we'd like to continue reading and discussing Nirsagadasa's conversation. And the questioner asks, is the practice of yoga always conscious, or can it be quite unconscious, below the threshold of awareness? Well, is the practice of Zen always conscious? We have a very sort of crude understanding of the mind in the West. We've got the conscious and the unconscious, and that's as far as it goes. It's true there are such variations as preconscious and subconscious, but it all means that the consciousness is supreme, that the other, what we call consciousness for the moment, if you like, are inferior. And the aim, at least of psychoanalysis, was always to make the unconscious conscious. The famous, where there is id, let there be ego, was Freudian's slogan. But another way of looking at the mind is possible, and this is more in accordance with the Buddhist way of seeing it. It's more in the way of, for example, the Lankavatara Sutra, although this way that I must confess is more my way than the Lankavatara, but there's a very close connection between the two. Because what we call the conscious mind is really what we might also call the I-awareness mind. This I-awareness is all-pervasive as well. We're so used to this word I-awareness or I that we take it totally for granted. The whole world is permeated by this sense of I. And as we say, it is a kind of reality. Without it, we feel there would be no world. Pink-coloured glasses. And if you wore them long enough, then eventually one would be convinced that the whole world was pink. But this eye-consciousness, eye-awareness mind, which could also be called the discriminating mind, insofar as this is the mind of yes and no, good and bad, right and wrong, and all the rest of it. One person called it the torchlight mind. It lights things up in isolation. Everything is isolated from everything else. And this is where we believe that there is things in the world. And one must see this. One must try to get into seeing what we're talking about when we're talking about this torchlight mind. This person has also called it awareness of mind. That we're aware of things, and as a consequence, we necessarily believe that they're separate from us. And this person is asking, is the practice of yoga always within this mind? And unfortunately, the answer to that is, in the main, for most people, yes. This is the mind where people make up their minds, so to say. They're going to do something. They feel that they're in control. This person, in passing, we should mention the fact that this mind is also, in the main, a reactive mind. It reacts to situations. And what happens when anybody sits and they're tied up in this mind is they're reacting constantly to the emotions, to the feelings, to the thoughts and so on that surge up. But deeper than that, there is this true mind. There is this what this person once called a lantern mind. It lights up everything. It is the creative mind. It is the mind which is beyond opposites. But that does not mean to say there are no opposites, but it's beyond the opposites. This is what makes up the creativity. And beyond this mind further, it is what we could call the no-self or the Buddha nature or whatever. This mind, this further mind, Buddha nature, animates, is responsible for the light that shines through the other minds. It is that which motivates, which gives it energy, which gives it dynamism and direction. This, if you like, is the true mind. When you're sitting and you're following the breath, we ask you to allow the breath to breathe. But what we're asking you also is to allow this deeper creative mind to take over. This is the mind that really will enter into the question. Because it is a creative mind, it is also a mind of tensions. And by allowing the breath to breathe, by releasing oneself from this constant need to discriminate, to judge, to analyze, to name, this is what we mean by allowing. By allowing the breath to breathe, we allow the deeper mind to take over. And to the extent that that is able, is when we get into a kind of samadhi. There's a sense of unity. It's a vibrant openness of mind, a vibrant sense of being. And when this is predominant, then this further mind, the true self, can enter in, and this is the moment of explosion. So the question is the practice of Zen always conscious, or can it be quite unconscious, below the threshold of awareness? So you can see there's all kinds of jumbles of words there. But let us see quite clearly that what we call the conscious mind is like waves. This deeper lantern mind is the sea. One could have the sea without the waves, but one cannot have the waves without the sea. And Nirsagarata says, in the case of a beginner, the practice of yoga is often deliberate and requires great determination. And this is where one is constantly struggling. This is the surface mind. It is constantly at work. This is where one has these ambitions, these hopes, these illusions, this belief that there's something possible, this sense of energy that comes as a reaction to these illusions and dreams that we have. And then he says, but those who are practicing sincerely for many years are intent on self-realization all the time, whether conscious of it or not. If one is truly open to the practice, if one is truly allowing the breath to breathe, or if one is truly allowing the question to arise, the tension inherent in the human situation to arise, then it is no longer truly necessary for there to be what one would call a formal practice. This does not mean to say that one no longer needs to sit in Zazen, or to have a regular period of sitting and so on, the discipline. Because without that discipline, then there is very little that one can do. But this is simply creating the vessel, so to say. As you know, in alchemy, it is said that first one must create a hermetically sealed vessel. And sitting in Zazen with a good posture, a low centre of gravity, the head up in alignment with the body, the eyes down, and the hands with the thumbs slightly touching, this is the hermetically sealed vessel. It doesn't leak. And it is this leaking, that particularly in leaking in terms of protests, leaking in terms of I don't know right what I'm supposed to be doing, this grumble, grisly grunt that goes on, this is leaking. If one is in a good posture, then it is possible for these deeper, dynamic, creative energies to surge up. And it is this that is important. And it's the formal practice simply gives it direction. When you're working on the question, for example, who am I? What is important is the questioning. We liken it to an arrow. There is the shaft of the arrow, and this is the questioning. And this comes out of the sense of dissatisfaction, the conflict, the grunt of existence. It is this grunt of existence that the discriminating mind has been set up to combat. We're constantly looking on the bright side. We're constantly looking on, well, things are not so bad. Or constantly looking on, tomorrow things will be different. This is the functioning of this mechanical mind. Or alternatively, oh, things are terrible, things will never get any better, I'm no good. This is still functioning of the mechanical mind in the hope of blocking, of putting some kind of stop on this real deep sense of dissatisfaction. Because the sense of dissatisfaction is not the fact that I'm living in this or that house or I'm married to this or that person or I've got this or that job. The sense of dissatisfaction, the sense there is something better, there's something more, the sense that there is somehow a heaven is inherent in the human situation because it is true. The life that we're living is ridiculous. The kinds of things that we look upon as important are tragic. The sort of things that we will get into very heated arguments over are petty. And in the face of this, in the recognition at a deep level, at this third level, of the light of life that is being thwarted. No wonder there is dissatisfaction. And so therefore one must be open to that dissatisfaction. One must not try to block it off. One must not look upon it as a failure, as a sense, well, that means to say that my life has been ruined or whatever it might be. There's this real feeling of depression almost, this cloud, this anguish. This comes right out of the human situation, and unless one can see this and have the courage to work with it, then one will always be working on this surface mind. And as we say, a person that has been working sincerely over a number of years has opened up to this feeling. What is so sad, so terribly sad, is that very often when people do open up to this feeling, which very often is accompanied by a sense of loss of interest in all kinds of things that before were sort of motivators, are no longer present. And we feel, well, there's a greyness of life. And also the suffering, it becomes more acute. That anguish of being becomes more present. And people say, oh, God, Zazen is no good. Look what it's led me to. This, I'm no better than I was. In fact, I'm a lot worse than I was 5 or 6 years ago. As we say, this surface mind has lost its grip. It is no longer capable of doing that job that it was originally set up to do, which was to put everything in a different light, in a rosy light. In other words, it takes years of practice to get to this state where people say, well, it is no good, and they leave. But those who are practicing sincerely for many years are intent on self-realization all the time, whether conscious of it or not. Unconscious practice is most effective because it is spontaneous and steady. In other words, once you've opened up the sluice gate to this deeper mind, then it is constantly present. What really happens then is that what was originally suffering, once one has worked through it well, becomes a creative force. You see, suffering comes out of conflict. It is the very conflict of the self against the self, of the self swallowing the self. This is the real anguish. This is the real suffering. But at the same time, creativity comes out of conflict. And it is a switch around. It is not a substitute of one for the other. It is not we get rid of one thing and something else comes up. But it is simply the same situation worked in a different way. And it is when he talks about self-realization, it is not self-realization, really, that is constantly there. It is this opening up to what is real, this constant sense of the reality, this constant sense of the beyond, if you like. This is what this deeper mind lives with. And then the question asks, what is the position of a person who was a sincere student of Zen for some time and then got discouraged and abandoned all efforts? This is what we were talking about just now. And it is very common. There are all kinds of people that have been through this center and stayed sometimes for years and then drifted away and we lose touch with them. But Nisargadatta says this, what a person appears to do or not do is often deceptive. The apparent lethargy may be just a gathering of strength. The causes of our behaviour are very subtle. One must not be quick to condemn, nor even praise. Now, this doesn't only apply to people that have got discouraged and left, but it also applies to people who are practicing and get discouraged. One of the feelings that is possibly most difficult to work with in practice is the feeling nothing is happening. But this feeling of nothing is happening is undoubtedly the feeling that the surface mind has lost its capability to operate. It is like something which was tied up to a post and it's now become free and it's running around, it doesn't know where to go, what to do, how to do it. And this is very often accomplished by a lethargy, a lack of the zest for life, the zest for practice. Practice becomes just sheer hard work. Getting to the sort of mat is like walking through thick mud. The Christians call this condition the dark night of the soul. And St. John of the Cross, you may have read something I've written on this in one of the books, describes it extremely well. This feeling that God has forsaken you is the way that he would put it. But we would put it, the feeling that the practice is no good. The practice is a failure. The practice is not giving what it promised. But of course, the practice can't be a success or a failure. There is no practice, and this is why we ask you not to practice Zen. What is a failure? What doesn't work anymore? What is sort of betrayed you is your interpretation of the practice. And as a consequence, this feeling of despair, of discouragement, of the sense of having lost one's way, of having lost one's faith, this is a condition to be really prized, to be nurtured, to be guarded. It means to say that your enemy is losing ground. And this is why he says one must not be quick to condemn. In other words, one mustn't be quick to condemn the practice. But of course, as he says, one mustn't be quick to praise. One mustn't get excited because there's a certain feeling of vast space or a sense of real light of being and openness and so on. These are indicators, both the valleys and the peaks are indicators. See them as such. And see it all. Everything that happens from now on, see it as grist to the mill. See it as whatever it is, as a success. You see, we've said so often that what we call success in life is really a failure in practice. The ability to be taken up by some project, to be praised, to be involved, to have to be able to spend one's time in the adulation of people and the feeling that everyone loves you. And this we look upon in Zen as a failure, because one has lost one's way, one has sold one's soul to the devil, one sold one's soul for the price of a bowl of porridge. But when we get this sort of sense of being up against it, that nothing moves, that we're facing an impossible situation, that when we look upon that, then other people, you describe that to people, and they, oh God, that's awful. That's a real failure. But as we say, in Zen, what is looked upon as a failure is really a great success. Everything is on its head. If one really wants to practice, then one must learn how to stand on one's hands. He says, remember that Zen is the work of the inner self, not the outer. All that the outer does is merely respond to the inner. It is reacting to what is going on. And this is where we get this discriminating mind that sees this, what one might call darkness, and judges it as bad. Is it giving over to the wrong aspect of the mind to start judging your practice, judging it as good or bad? when you find yourself doing this, go to the source, to the pain that underlies it. We can't encourage you enough to work with that pain of life. One can't get away from it. It's not that Zen brings it on, and it is not that a successful or meaningful life will take it away. We're wounded. And once one opens up to that, once one works with that, we can go beyond it. It is not pessimism that we're talking about here. It is not sort of putting everything down into a pit of despond. But unless you've seen the problem, you cannot get the solution. Unless you've seen the reality of the situation, you cannot go beyond that situation. This is why we talk so much about suffering, because it is through that that you'll find what you're looking for, not by avoiding it. The way out of suffering is through suffering. If you knew how to suffer, you would have the power not to suffer. And the question says, still the outer helps. This discriminating mind helps. And it does. You see, we have to learn, we have to appreciate the map of the terrain that we're going to cover. This is why this person has written books, to try to set out the kind of structure that we're dealing with in practice. And this is really what the sutras did in their way. That to believe that all that one has to do is to sit down, close your eyes and hope for the best, this is no good. In fact, we read this morning about some psychologist who was talking about the importance of mindfulness. And she was saying that what one must do is observe the thoughts, and thoughts that are disturbing, dismiss them. Now, this is just the opposite of what one must do. It is terrible to see this, and she's being given all this kind of, I mean, it's the Washington Post that is being published. And so this is where the discriminating mind can help. It is in knowing what the problem is. It's helping to get to know what the problem is that the discriminating mind can help. But it cannot help in its resolution. This is where the conscious mind, the discriminating mind, exceeds its bounds. It should take you up to the doorway and then leave you. And then you have to go through it. But the discriminating mind cannot take you through it. Now try to see what I'm talking about. This is where the discriminating mind can help. See what I'm talking about when I talk about these different levels of mind. It is important. You're asked to have faith. But this is not faith in a sort of throwing up your hands and hoping. It is the realization that beyond this realm of experience, the realm that is given to us by the conscious mind, beyond that there is a reality which is far more real, far greater, far more powerful, far more creative than this discriminating mind. We want you to see this, and then there'll be much more of an intent when you allow the mind to allow the breath to breathe. You're allowing into your life the real salvation of your life. Still, the outer helps, And Nirsagarata says, but how can it help and in what way? And then he says, we gain some control over the body and can improve its posture and breathing. Over the mind's thoughts and feelings we have little mastery, for we are ourselves the mind. It is the inner that can control the outer, and the outer will be wise to obey. Well, there's the question of control, and this person's a bit unhappy with that, because control, that the inner does not control. That is not how it there's that sort of influences, you might say. It gives the context within which something can happen. It allows in its own way. Control is really the problem. And the fear of the loss of control is one of the basic fears that we have. When we want to control, it is the sense of I that comes to the fore. To control is for I to dominate. I to overcome, I to be in the driver's seat. And this need to control is going on all the time. It is a constant feature of our life. We want others to think as we do. We want other people to do as we do. We're constantly wanting things to happen this way rather than that. We want to stop things from happening that we don't like. We want to change things, and so on. We even get fed up with the weather when it doesn't do what we want to do. And if we can't change it, actually physically, make a physical difference, then we start changing it sort of what you might call mentally. This is where we get anxious and worried and anguished over what's going on. One of the fascinating things that people come into the Dokusan room sometimes anguishing over the state of the world. We can't do anything about the state of the world, so why anguish over it? Let it do it what it's going to do. It will do it anyway, whether you anguish over it or not. If it is true that the mind is ultimately responsible for our spiritual development, why is the outer so much exhorted and encouraged? Because, you see, this is one of the things in Zen, we emphasize constantly, the need for the posture. And let me again reiterate that do look, make sure your posture has a straight back and a low centre of gravity, that the head is held up and the shoulders are relaxed, that the sort of focus of your attention is in the pit of the stomach, in the hara. See the diaphragm as free. In that way, you can open up the torso, and you're no longer breathing with the chest breathing. The chest breathing is emergency breathing. One way, by the way, in which you can always start a round of practice, and it's not a bad way at all in order to sort of settle the breathing down, is to breathe out. And then when you've breathed out all that you can breathe out a bit more, and then breathe out a bit more. In that way, you'll be able to fill the lungs completely, and it will open up your breathing in a way. This is not something that one does other than just right at the beginning of the round of practice. The other way, of course, is to try to touch the ceiling with the top of your head. This will stretch the spine. But all of this is emphasized. And the thing is that it sets the sort of the tone. You can see this quite yourself, that when you hang your head down, your shoulders slump, your back bends, then there's a feeling of weakness, of not being able to cope, of flabbiness. There's no coincidence that in the army or the navy, one is told to stand up straight, chest out, stomach in. All right, this is not Zen, but at least it's recognised that the posture, that kind of posture, is the posture of pride. It's the posture of, I'm here, in sort of feeling. You see a sergeant major that stands like that and you know he's there. So in other words, the posture is important, very important. But also, as Nyasagadatta says, the outer can help by keeping quiet and free from desire and fear. Well, I'm not sure about that, but anyway, it is this, you can see what is unreasonable. The discriminating mind can see that, for example, it is unreasonable to expect the whole of your life is going to change overnight. That's unreasonable. But even so, many people come to Zen in the belief that it is possible. But once you see it as unreasonable, it will no longer be a feature of your practice. You'll be able to take your time, so to say. You won't be in a hurry in the same way. There will be a sense of freedom. You would have noticed that all the advice to the outer is in the form of negations. Don't, refrain, forego, give up, sacrifice, surrender, see as false, false, and also, of course, allow. In other words, it is taking away that false sense of initiative, of the ability to control that the conscious mind has. We feel that the conscious mind can do things, and it cannot. The conscious mind can do nothing. It is simply a conduit, a pipe through which the life can flow, that is all. And it can be a good one or a bad one. And it is a good one to the extent that it doesn't impede, it doesn't block, it doesn't hold up. And of course, one of the worst ways that this discriminating mind impedes and blocks and holds up is when people attack themselves. When they say, oh, I'm no good, or I can't do this, or it's all right for you, but what about poor me, sort of attitude. This is something where you can certainly stop. Give that up. Let that go. It is of no use other than to give you the comfort that you don't have to put out effort. If I'm no good, if I'm just a poor, weak thing, if I've got no, then I don't have to make the effort because I know I can't. It's just beyond me, and it's all right for other people. So I don't have to, you know, that kind of. It's a way of avoiding the pain of being. Even the little description of reality that is given is through denials. Not this, not this. All positives belong to the inner self. That is really what is important. It's not only that this outer mechanical eye awareness mind is has to be seen in terms of denial, but it also that it has no power. and yet it assumes the position of power. One of the analogies that is given in spirituality very often is that of the servant taking over from the owner. The discriminating mind, the surface mind, is the servant. You use it. You use it in your daily life. When you go to the supermarket, you can't rely on the inner mind to make choices because it doesn't. You have to choose between this apple and that apple. So in other words, it's a servant. It serves you in negotiating the world. And of course, this is where good understanding is very useful, because the better you understand the situation, the better you can work within it. The questioner asks, how are we to distinguish the inner from the outer in actual experience? And he says, the inner is the source of inspiration. That's what we were saying earlier. When you allow, when you're just with it, when you're open, when the breath just comes in and the breath goes out, then you're open to the life force that you are. This is the inspiration. But the outer is moved by memory. And this is, we base our life on what has been. One of the best examples of this is that most people realize that all generals fight the last war. That we remember how things were, and so therefore we know how things will be. And it is this which is a very sort of dead way of looking at the world. But it takes courage to let go of all of that that we have experienced and learnt, and to just be open to the moment, to act in a spontaneous, unpremeditated way. But this is real life. The source is untraceable, while memory begins somewhere. As we say, that when we go beyond the lantern mind, when we go to that open mind, that where we are aware as all that is, there is this light of the life. It is the cognition. It is the knowing. It is the vitality that we are. Whereas memory begins, it begins today, and it begins when I'm born. Thus the outer is always determined, while the inner cannot be held in words. We cannot act spontaneously when we are working from this outer mind. This is why we ask, who are you? And everybody sort of comes to a grinding halt, because they then switch directly into this outer mind. They lack the courage, the faith, to stay within that deeper mind, and it is that deeper mind that can respond spontaneously. And spontaneously, by the way, does not mean necessarily sudden or in a knee-jerk fashion. And it certainly doesn't necessarily mean that you have to shout. The mistake of students consists in their imagining the inner to be something to get hold of, and forgetting that all perceivables are transient and therefore unreal. Again, this is where faith comes in. I talk about this deeper mind, and yet if anybody says, well, what is it? It is totally beyond any kind of description. You've heard this many times said before. We can give metaphors and we can give some kind of pointers, but that's as far as it goes. And it is being willing to let go of that need to grab, to seize, to have and to hold that our practice is about. It is that we want to transcend this mind that lacks courage and life. It is a leap that is made. It is a leap without any idea of how you're going to do it, why you're going to do it, or where you're going to land.
All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passion. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain